This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Connecticut's two tribal casinos, run by the Mashantucket Pequots and Mohegans, have become two of the largest casinos in the world and have made billions of dollars for the state through a slot sharing deal. They've employed thousands of Connecticut residents in a region that had been hard hit by job losses. But the casinos have their detractors, too, and that's one reason why Connecticut lawmakers have lined up to oppose more federally recognized tribes within our state and more casinos that might come with them. That opposition is about more than gambling. It's also about the possibility of land claims by three tribes seeking recognition: the Eastern Pequots of North Stonington, the Golden Hill Pegossets of Colchester and Trumbull, and the Scaticokes of Kent. Now, with the Federal Bureau of Indian Affairs considering new rules for tribal recognition, this debate has been shaken up once again. What could this all mean for the state's current deals with tribal casinos? What could it mean for landowners? Could it mean more casinos in Connecticut? You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can email wherewelive at WNPR.org. You can tweet us at Where We Live. And as always, you can follow along at WNPR.org. We're going to be joined by some experts, people who've been following this very closely. But I want to welcome into our conversation first Governor Daniel Malloy, who wrote a letter to President Obama about these proposed new rules being proposed by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Governor, welcome back to our show. Thanks for joining us.
Sure. It's great to be with you.
I'm wondering if, first of all, you can describe what is in your letter to President Obama.
Well, what's in the letter is pointing out that the procedures and rules which Interior may adopt basically has an adverse effect in one state, and that's Connecticut. And that's because we have already gone to court and had these issues decided. Two tribes were recognized as meeting what was the historic criteria, and others were deemed not to have met that criteria. What this will do, this new procedure and policy coming out of Interior, if it was adopted, would be basically to throw 40 years of rulings, court rulings, decisions, Interior Department looks at this, would throw it out in favor of a new rule that simply says that if you were ever recognized for any purpose at all, including cultural purposes as opposed to legal purposes, then you're automatically deemed a tribe. And obviously that would fly in the face of everything that's happened over the last 40 years.
One of the things that, you and other lawmakers who have opposed this have pointed out is that these new rules seem to be written in a way so as to target Connecticut almost specifically.
I believe they are. I know the folks at the Interior say that that's not the case. I've asked them repeatedly if any other state would be impacted by that particular rule after a judicial decision has been made, and they have been unable to point to any state. So simply what we're saying is you can have your rule the way you've drafted it, just exclude those situations where this issue has already been tried before fact finders, gone to court, and decisions have been rendered. If that simple change to their language is made, they can have the effect that they want in 49 states, but they won't be throwing out what we've done in the state of Connecticut. And let's point out, it's not as if the state of Connecticut and the court system don't recognize tribes. We have two tribes that are recognized. They are independent nations, tribal nations within our jurisdiction. So this is not about that issue. It's about whether folks have met the test in the past.
Now, one of the questions, of course, has to do with, is this all about more tribal gaming? Is this all about casinos? When you think about this, how much of your stance on this issue has to do with the possibility of more tribal gaming coming to the state?
That's really not a factor in our considerations, at least within my administration. There are other factors, such as land claims, such as the company to which we or how we will treat these nations in the future if they were to be so recognized. But if you're asking whether it's about casinos, for us, the answer is no.
When you talk about the land claims, let's be more specific. Are there specific landowners or parts of the state where you're more concerned about this having a major impact than others?
I would say Fairfield County, Litchfield County, New London County would all be very, could potentially be very adversely impacted.
Have you had any conversations with the two federally recognized tribes in the state that operate the two casinos, and whether or not these new rules would impact the state's deal with those tribes at all?
No, it would not, it would not have that kind of impact. These are not exclusive to these two tribes. These are, in essence, they're written in such a way as they're exclusive to any nation that would be recognized, tribal nation that would be recognized for the purpose of laying out how they might get into the casino business.
But I guess another way of asking that is, if indeed these rules were to go through and it was to change the status of the three tribes that have been seeking federal recognition, and then they might be able to get into the casino business.
Correct.
Wouldn't that essentially change the nature of the agreement that you have with the Mashantucket Pequots and with the Mohegans?
No, it wouldn't, John. Those agreements would stay in place, and presumably any other tribal nation so recognized would live within the basic compact. So what tribal recognition is deemed to do is to put the state in a position to negotiate with those tribal nations. We've done that. We followed a basic plan. We've reached agreements with those nations that were procedures were held on and with, and they were deemed to be tribal nations, and we entered into compacts with them. I would imagine that any other nation so recognized would enter into a similar compact. Now, does it have implications? Of course it has implications, but that's a business matter for those tribal nations currently in the business, not for us.
We're talking with Governor Daniel Malloy about tribal recognition in the state. You can join us at 860-275-7266. You can email wherelive at WNPR.org. You can also tweet us at wherelive. I want to bring in Bethany Berger, who is a professor of real property at the University of Connecticut School of Law, located just down the street from us. And Bethany, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks. And actually, although my chair is in real property, I'm also a professor of American Indian Law.
Excellent. Thank you very much for clearing that up. Well, first of all, I just would like to ask, from a broad standpoint, while we have the governor on the line here, maybe you can lay out some of the issues here that might affect the state of Connecticut. When you look at whether it's the governor or the members of our federal delegation opposing the rules changes here, what do you see?
So, historically, land claims have been a big issue in tribal recognition because tribes that were recognized could bring claims against the state or against individual property owners for land taken illegally in the past. That changed with a decision in 2005, Sherrill County versus Oneida Indian Nation. And since then, essentially, land claims have become pretty toothless. Tribes can no longer bring land claims against the state that are going to be recognized in this area. So that's no longer an issue. The tribes that are recognized do on recognized land have some immunity from state jurisdiction, and that would apply to any recognized tribe. They also have a claim to federal funding for health care and things like that. They also have the right, as Governor Malloy said, to negotiate for gaming on their land. That, given the limitation of land claims, is the most significant impact I see to the state of Connecticut if further tribes were recognized, because I believe that the payments that the state gets from the existing recognized tribes are dependent on their exclusivity in gaming in the state, and adding tribes to that would affect that exclusivity.
Yeah, the governor was suggesting that it doesn't affect that. Are you reading it differently?
I am reading it differently. If there's been a change in the last few years since I last looked at it, that would be a change, but my understanding is that the condition on which these tribes pay a portion of their slot revenue to the state is that they're the exclusive gamers in the state.
Governor, could you just expand on that for us?
Yeah, sure. I'm happy to. Our position is that the professor is partially right, that what we've agreed to do is to recognize tribal nations as the entities that can conduct gaming, the likes of which we have at two casinos. And that's exclusive to those nations or any other nations that might subsequently be recognized. To put it another way, we believe we have an exclusive agreement with the two tribal nations, but if other nations were to be recognized, those nations would still have to honor the agreements.
And quickly, back to this, the land claims question, Professor Berger.
So let me explain that, John. So for instance, the state of Connecticut is prohibited from licensing any other non-tribal gaming entity. So we can't enter into having a casino industry that was publicly owned, nor could we recognize any other company to come into our state to conduct gaming. If we were to do that, that would violate the compacts that we have with the two tribal nations, and therefore we would no longer be in a position to claim those monies that we get as a percentage of the slot gambling.
I just quickly before I have to let you go, Governor, I just wanted to have Professor Berger talk about the land claims piece of it. It sounds to me from just what you said earlier, Professor, that you would not be as concerned from the Connecticut point of view about the possibility of the taking of lands by tribal entities were they to get federal recognition.
That's right. There's been both a 2005 Supreme Court decision that casts some doubt on it and the Second Circuit, which is the federal circuit that governs this area, has subsequently said that tribes no longer have the power to bring claims that would result either in transfer of land or in damages payments for illegal taking of land from tribes.
Because I have to go, let me just say this about the professor's position, and that is that we don't believe that this is that's the case, that this is a dead issue at all. We believe that, and particularly in light of the Interior Department's new rules, that in all likelihood land claims will be made. Once made, by the way, and then litigated over a period of years, they stain the title of private ownership of land as well as other governmental entities. I will just remind all of the listeners that we're now debating that in our state, years, decades after final determination was made, so there is no never in the law, quite frankly. And I think this Supreme Court has proven that time and time again as they've reversed themselves in prior positions. I mean, I practiced law for a fair amount of time. If you had asked me whether I ever thought that the tribes that had fully litigated their claims and had been found and the ruling had been found not in their favor would ever be in the position they're in today, I would have said, of course not. It's been fully litigated. It's been before Interior. It's been before the courts. Ultimately, a decision was made. There is no claim. But here we're on the radio today debating this very issue in light of changes that may be coming about on a rulemaking process. I certainly would not look my citizens in the face, given all of this, and say to you in Kent, Connecticut, or anywhere in Litchfield, or anywhere in the northern half of Fairfield County, or anywhere in New London, that I absolutely guarantee you that land claims will not be made and will not be prosecuted successfully. I certainly wouldn't say to those folks, in fact, we'll guarantee that. We'll hold you harmless of any losses you suffer as a state as a result of that. And I'm willing to bet that the professor would not tell me that I should enter into agreement to hold all parties harmless if such claims were made.
Governor Dana Malloy joined us for a few minutes. He recently wrote a letter to President Barack Obama about the proposed rule changes. Thank you very much, sir. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
When we come back from our break, we're going to have further conversation with Professor Bethany Berger. We're also going to bring in AP reporter Mike Melia, who's been following this very closely. And we want to hear from you, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The federal government is considering new rules for tribal recognition that could mean good news for some of the tribes that are looking for tribal recognition. These plans are being fought by Connecticut lawmakers, including Governor Malloy, who we just heard from on the program. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Bethany Berger is from the Connecticut School of Law. She joins us today. And also joining us on the phone right now is Mike Melia, who's a reporter for the Associated Press. Mike, welcome to Where We Live. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, good morning. Thanks for having me.
You heard from the governor just a moment ago. How have the tribes that are seeking recognition reacted to this push by Connecticut lawmakers?
They're frustrated. But then again, this is a fight that's been going on for some time. I think part of the reason that this is facing so much opposition in Connecticut is that these battle lines were drawn so long ago. These smaller tribes think that they have a chance here to get closer than they have in the past to recognition. To see that the governor and the entire congressional delegation take a stand against these rules that might help them is frustrating, at least to the Skaticoke tribe that I've been in touch with. Frankly, the other two tribes have been hard to get in touch with the right contact person.
Well, one thing that we know, and I have covered the Skaticoke tribe in the past, and it's been years since I've been on the reservation when indeed they were granted federal recognition, and then that was rescinded some time ago. This is a tribe, for people who don't know the story, that at least currently is somewhat in factions. It's not exactly easy to know who represents the Skaticoke tribe, is it, Mike?
No, not at all. There are two factions that each claim to represent the true tribe, and there's an ongoing fight to bring members from one side to the other. But one thing that's interesting to me in covering this is, even though these tribes are sometimes disorganized and it's sometimes hard to know who to talk to, and there's only a handful of people left on these state reservations, in some ways they don't look very different from the way the Mashantucket Pequots looked back in the 1970s. They had only a couple people left on their reservation before they started the push that led to them getting recognized in the 80s and then go on to build Foxwoods.
We're talking with Mike Melia, who's a reporter for the Associated Press. He's been covering tribal recognition. If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. We actually reached out to members of the Skaticoke tribe and were unsuccessful in getting anyone on. But here's a little bit from Richard Velke. He's a tribal chief. This is me speaking with him back in 2004 when they originally granted federal recognition.
This land is our homeland that dates back to the 1700s. Other people have countries in which they can go to. We don't need to go to a country. Our country is right here. It was unjustly taken from us, and we expect it to be returned.
That's, again, Richard Velke speaking with me for an NPR story back in 2004. Now, here is then-Congressman Christopher Shays and his reaction.
It is absolutely outrageous that we would be so casual in allowing a nation within a nation that has total of sovereignty over land within the United States of America. No, you better be real sure that nation deserves to be recognized as a federally recognized tribe.
So, Professor Bethany Berger, maybe we can just go back in time a little bit. What the governor was saying earlier is that a reason why he is rejecting this new push by the BIA is because he sees that the question of these tribes, including the Skaticokes, has already been settled in court. It's already been through this process at least once, if not a few times before. How do you read the history of, say, the Skaticoke recognition, given that the BIA accepted them, then rejected them, then it's been back in court, that there's literally more than one tribe calling itself the Skaticokes right now? How do you read all this?
Well, I think you summarized it pretty well, that there was a very long process of many years in which the tribe was petitioning for recognition. They finally got a positive final determination of recognition. It went through an administrative appeal. They said, take a look at it again. Under a different political administration, they withdrew that finding of recognition based on only two of, I think, the seven criteria for recognition. And then it went to court, and it wasn't a substantive evaluation court. It was simply, was this unduly influenced by all of the political lobbying that occurred to prevent the recognition? And the court said that it wasn't unduly influenced by that political process. But they didn't take a look at that administrative recognition, which, as you said, has gone back and forth and, in fact, was built on top of hundreds of years of process of sort of recognition, sort of not recognition
well,
in the state.
And I think that that's part of the thing that, the governor and others are taking a look at is the state has indeed recognized these tribes for quite some time. And now it seems as though the state's own recognition of these tribes, as well-meaning as it is being used in some ways by the federal government to legitimize a federal claim. The state says, well, we believe we've been doing the right thing for the last couple hundred years, and now essentially it's being thrown back in our face.
And it goes back to this very difficult question of what is a tribe? A tribe is more than just a collection of Indian people. It has to involve some political and cultural and external recognition. And what the proposed new regulations would do is say, if you can show that the predominant portion of your members have descended from an historical tribe, and you can show that there's been a significant form of political recognition, which could include a state-recognized reservation since 1934 to the present, then you can have an expedited positive finding. And so they are using that, but that's because that recognizing a tribe is primarily a political recognition.
I want to bring into the conversation Doug Keel, who's a postdoctoral fellow in history at the University of Pennsylvania, adjunct professor of history at Columbia, who's been following this issue very, very closely as well. And Doug, first of all, welcome to Where We Live. I appreciate you joining us.
Thank you for having me.
As the professor was just saying, the terminology is very important and in some cases very, very confusing. Can we maybe go through what the term recognition really means as you view it, Doug?
Well, the entire process is one that's really quite odd, of course, in which the federal government has the authority to recognize indigenous governments that pre-exist the United States. There are some good arguments among some tribal communities for even refusing to take part in this recognition process and to give it legitimacy. In certain ways, we see how the state is able to play a role, especially in regard to this case of gaming, that the state is able to play a role in determining who does and does not get to become a tribe. The tribes in question were already recognized, even, and that there was an appeals process, makes this something that's much more subjective than maybe it seems on its surface.
We were talking with the governor of the state of Connecticut earlier, Doug. He seems to think that the way these new BIA rules are being drawn up would specifically target a place like Connecticut, where indeed there are three tribes that are seeking federal recognition that have been recognized by the state for quite some time. I'm wondering if you can draw us out a little bit and tell us how you see these rules maybe impacting the rest of the country, or is this really a Connecticut question here?
It's certainly not just a Connecticut question, though I do think New England and Connecticut in particular has become an important site for these kinds of issues. There's some problems with the language that the governor is using. He's essentially drumming up a lot of panic. As Professor Berger has mentioned, land claims are not a real viable possibility, more than likely. And it's often framed in terms of a zero-sum game, right? That for tribes to gain the right to govern themselves does not necessarily mean that the state of Connecticut loses on something. There's a few major problems with the way that the issue gets framed. First, it's not unfair to the state of Connecticut that the state may soon have to acknowledge and recognize a few new tribal governments within the state. But what is unfair, what is deeply unjust, if we're to use that language, is to be dispossessed of one's land, to have your history erased, and then to be put in a position where you have to ask for your rights back. And partly what's going on here too in the rhetoric of the opposition is this idea that we can't possibly reverse past decisions, right? That we can't implement these new changes to the policy and reverse past decisions. But if we're going to to play that game. If we're going to be on that topic, then let's talk about upholding each and every one of our past Indian treaties, all 370 of them. I don't think that's a conversation that folks opposed to tribal recognition necessarily want to have.
I want to bring back quickly into the conversation Mike Melia, an AP reporter who's been covering this very closely. We've heard both of the professors say that this idea of land claims really aren't necessarily going anywhere. The governor of the state doesn't necessarily agree. What are you hearing from people in the towns where these three tribes have reservations right now? What are the concerns that you're hearing, Mike?
In a lot of these towns, they thought that this fight was over when these various tribes were denied recognition. And a year or so ago, when they first saw these new proposals from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they got very frightened and they were startled. And they got back in touch with their lawyers and started planning a whole new fight for what they expect to be land claims if and when these tribes do get recognized. Out in Kent, where the Scaticooks are based, there is concern that longstanding claims of the tribe to land currently owned by the Kent School could be validated. And in North Stonington, where the Eastern Pequots have been seeking recognition, there's also concern that that tribe could pursue land, developed land, beyond the borders of what is their state reservation.
And, of course, in the instance of Kent, for instance, it would seem unlikely that even if there were land claims made and there was federal recognition granted, Mike, that there would ever be a high-stakes gambling operation happening in Kent, Connecticut. But as we've seen in the past, potentially the tribe might look to expand gambling elsewhere in the state. Or are people in Kent worried about a casino actually coming to the far western edges of the state?
No, even the tribe will tell you that there's no chance of a casino opening up there in the hills of Kent. But one goal that they do have, granted it's a long road, but if they do get recognition, one thing they've talked about is trading land and perhaps getting access to some land along a highway in one of Connecticut's bigger cities and opening some sort of gambling operation there.
Yeah, 10 years ago we were talking about a potential casino in Bridgeport. Mike Melia is a reporter with the Associated Press. If you go to WNPR.org, you can see links to some of the reporting he's done on this. Mike, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
If you want to join us, 860-275-7266. David is calling from Woodbury. Hi there, David. Go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Oh, hello, everybody. I live on 22 acres of land on the Pomperog River, which is a small township within Woodbury on a no outlet road with about 18 houses on it, and it is land of the former Pututuk Nation, and this township is named Pomperog after Chief Pomperog, In the early days when the English came, it was a synergistic relation because there's a ridge that there would be lookouts against the invading Mohawks or Terfiers, but they would take refuge in the English people's cellars when they came, but the English would be warned, so it was synergistic. But of course, they got bought out bit by bit, and the last part of them ended up at where the Pomperog River meets the Housatonic. And frankly, I feel I live on their land, and it is to be left to the Flanders Nature Center in the future as a nature preserve. But still, I still feel I'm living on their land. Yes, they got bought out, but obviously at a overly low price, and they ended up getting, pushed out in effect, but at a cheap price.
Well, David, first of all, thank you for sharing that story with us, and it goes to just how much of the land that we have here in our state has this deep and quite rich history. Doug Keel, I think one of the things that
gets overlooked when we start having conversation about politics and about tribal recognition, whether or not it might affect casinos and gambling and that sort of thing, is there really is quite a rich history that includes land that people have been on for years and years and years. And it seems as though we often just forget about that when we start having these very political conversations.
Certainly. And in some cases, it's not necessarily by accident. History itself is sometimes a political tool that in many cases, the narratives, the stories that we tell about the past, in so many cases, are really about serving our political needs in the present. And New England has been full of such examples in which indigenous histories have been deliberately erased for the purpose of supporting the legitimacy of occupation of native territory.
Well, we got an email from Jessica. It says, it doesn't matter whether federal recognition adversely affects Connecticut. The land we live on belongs to Native American people. And Governor Malloy's attempt to weasel out of giving back even a little bit of land and blocking other tribes' access to the benefits of federal recognition in favor of his largely white landowners' vote is shameful. That's an email from Jessica. I'm wondering, Professor Berger, if we can talk a little bit about what federal recognition really means to tribes beyond the ability to start their own casino, beyond the ability to potentially go after land that is adjacent. What are the benefits of federal recognition?
Sure. And one of the benefits is identity. It's peoples that have for hundreds of years asserted their identity as Indian tribes and finally having that recognized in a way that is much more without question than it is now. But there are lots of legal and practical benefits. And major one is support for their people's welfare. So there are health care benefits that come with recognition. There's support for education that comes with recognition and other things like that. There's also support to run their own government services, so to possibly provide welfare systems to their people rather than having the state do that, or to provide police services on their lands rather than having the state do that. There also is the ability to assert jurisdiction. It's pretty limited jurisdiction. It's significantly over tribal members, to some extent jurisdiction over non-members interacting with tribal members on Indian land. But big situation is if kids are taken away by the state in child welfare proceedings, the tribe can intervene, can even seek to have that case transferred to tribal court, which is a very important thing for tribes. So those are some of the major things. There's also support for language revitalization that tribes have more access to that I know the Wampanoag on Massachusetts have been very successful in doing. They're really a success story of that. And that's one of the many benefits that come with recognition.
I'm wondering if before we run out of time in this conversation, if you and then Doug Keel might just offer up what your thoughts are about how this might end up. Is this... now starting another conversation that may see massive changes, or is this really going to be a political fight at the end? Do you see actually tribes that are seeking recognition being able to have some sort of a constructive dialogue with the federal government about this at all? How do you see this playing out, Professor?
So I think these proposed regulations are an opening shot. They're intended to begin that discussion not only with tribes, but with states and with other players in this process. I'm not sure where it's going to end out. I would be delighted if I thought there could be a productive discussion between tribes and the state on these issues. I'm not seeing that starting, unfortunately. And if the end of this is that two more tribes are recognized in the state, that would be Skagit-Dakota and Eastern Pequot, because Golden Hill, even under the revised regulations, probably doesn't have a good shot at being recognized. The result would probably be that the existing reservations would be taken into trust, and tribes would assert jurisdiction over that. Even if there was a land claims that was not shut out of court very quickly, the result of land claims has been that tribes were given a defined area within which they could purchase land, some money to do that, and the only land that went into reservation hands would be land that the owners voluntarily sold to the tribes. Mm. No land has been involuntarily taken from anybody that was occupied under a land claim.
Doug Keel, do you have any thoughts about how this may go?
Sure. And, you know, actually, you know, as a different sort of twist in that question, I think in interesting ways, that's an important question. In some ways, as a precondition, in a way that perhaps it ought not be. Part of the question that hangs in the opposition to these pursuits is this idea of what are they going to do with their sovereign rights if they are recognized? And that really shouldn't be part of the conversation at all, to say that you can have your rights, but it depends on exactly how you plan to use them. We like to think of the United States as being founded upon the principle of freedom, but for Native people, rights are always conditional. And the arguments go something like this, that if we as Native people don't look a certain way, we're not authentic enough to be a tribe. If we have wealth, we no longer need sovereignty. And in this particular case, the governor's argument is that tribes in Connecticut should not be allowed to have rights if they plan to use them in court. When a right has conditions placed upon it, it ceases to be a right. That's a privilege. And Native American sovereignty is not a privilege. It is a right. I think it's vastly unpredictable to see where exactly these communities will head in their futures if they do become recognized. But the most important point here is that becoming recognized allows these communities to determine their own futures for themselves.
Doug Keel is a postdoctoral fellow at Penn and also an adjunct professor of history at Columbia. He joined us by phone today. Doug, thank you so much for joining us on Where We Live.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Professor Bethany Berger from the UConn School of Law. Thank you very much for your time and expertise. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much. And can I give a shout out to my student, Zachary Cole, who has written a great paper on the proposed new recognitions and their impact in Connecticut.
Excellent. Very, very good. If you send us the link, we will make sure that Zachary's work gets linked to as well.
Great.
At WNPR.org. When we come back, it is Selection Sunday for women's basketball, and ho-hum, UConn women's basketball is, again, a big favorite. We're going to be talking about women's sports coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, we're going to be talking about climate change on the program. How are we contributing to shifting weather patterns, and how are we adapting to these changing weather patterns as well? We'll also be getting a follow-up on last week's show about campus sexual assault from State Representative Roberta Willis. Those stories and quite a bit more coming up tomorrow on Where We Live. I hope you can join us, as always, on WNPR.org. We've been talking about a debate over Native American tribal recognition. The issue, of course, heated in Connecticut, where some fear more casinos might come if other tribes are recognized. Now, the state has two casinos, including Mohegan Sun, which has become one of the top entertainment destinations in our state. One of the attractions is women's basketball. The Connecticut Sun call the Mohegan Casino their home in the WNBA. Today's also a big day for women's college basketball. Selection Monday, UConn will be a number one seed, but there's a debate over which region they will play in. So coming up in just a little bit, we'll be talking about bracketology in the women's game. But first, Hartford Courant's Paul Doyle will join us to talk about some of our basketball DNA. Before UConn was winning national championships, there were teams like the Hartford Hurricanes, the Capitals, and the Hellcats. Paul Doyle, welcome back to Where We Live. Thanks for coming on.
Oh, it's nice to be here, John. Thank you.
So you were writing for the Courant for their 250th anniversary segment about basketball and other sports here in Connecticut. Let's talk about basketball, though, first. In some of the history here, before the ABA and NBA merged, Hartford was always thought of as a possible location for a team. Maybe you can talk a bit about pro basketball history here in the state.
Yeah, there's a long history of basketball. Amateur basketball has always been popular. UConn always had a place in the hearts of Connecticut sports fans. But there was always a thought that, you know, pro basketball could do well here. And when the Civic Center was being built in the early 70s, the ABA was very interested in Hartford. And, in fact, you know, the Hartford Whalers leader, Howard Baldwin, told me recently that he really became aware of Hartford after reading a story in a Boston paper about Charles O. Finley, who was sort of colorful owner of the Oakland Athletics baseball team. He also owned a Memphis ABA franchise. And Charlie Finley was interested in Hartford. And that was the first time Howard Baldwin sort of became aware that Hartford was building an arena, and you know, the rest is history. The Whalers wound up moving down here, but the ABA was very interested, and that actually led to the Celtics coming down and playing a handful of games every year in Hartford.
Well, and that is an interesting piece of history, right? The Celtics didn't want to have Hartford have an ABA or an NBA team,
right.
Certainly. So that's why we got to see Larry Bird play at the Civic Center.
Exactly. They sort of wanted to block the ABA, and it was pretty inevitable that there would be a merger, and you know, a handful of teams would wind up in the NBA, and the Celtics didn't want to lose this market, so they agreed to come down. This is long before the new, you know, Boston Garden was built, so the Celtics, they didn't mind coming down here and playing, you know, four games a year and, you know, cultivating the fan base down here. But part of that was also to keep the ABA out. And there had been, you know, a few owners. There was a proposal to have a team play, you know, games in Hartford, games in Springfield, and games in New Haven and be sort of a regional team in the ABA. And again, the thought was always that these teams would eventually try to get into the NBA and the healthiest franchises would probably survive the merger. So Hartford was thought of as, you know, as a market where, you know, pro basketball could do well.
Before we get back to a little bit more talk about pro basketball, I want to welcome in Charlie Cream, who's a women's college basketball bracketologist with ESPN. Charlie, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, good to be with you guys.
Of course, one of the things that has taken hold over the course of the last few decades here in Connecticut has been women's college basketball, maybe in a place here unlike any other when it comes to the women's game. It's Selection Monday. Many of us in Connecticut are eager to see where UConn women will play these games. Where do you think the Lady Huskies are going to end up here, Charlie?
Well, I think they will ultimately end up in the Lincoln region. Of course, they're going to play their first two games in stores, so no one has to go very far. As far as the opening two rounds go. But obviously the big question is which regional will they be placed in? And I ultimately think they will be in Lincoln, although that would somewhat go against the pattern of the committee in recent years, and that's sort of been the big debate. Put it in Louisville, which is a closer regional, which follows the pattern, but also would put them in the same regional as conference foe Louisville, a team they've played three times all year, if both teams were to make it to the Elite Eight. And that, of course, with Connecticut, that oftentimes seems like a foregone conclusion, but it's an addendum we have to add to that because it would require both teams to win three games before we even got to that point. But that's the debate. Follow the pattern of the committee and go a geographical route. Typically, it's done to save travel money and save travel time and things like that, or make what I would consider a better bracket by putting the Huskies in Lincoln, separating those two conference teams, balancing the bracket a little bit better. And since the Huskies are getting on a plane, whether they go to Louisville or whether they go to Lincoln, it seems fairly innocuous as to which place they would go. So I think they're going to end up in Lincoln. I think the committee will make what most people who follow us very closely perceive as the best decision. But you never know. The committee has done things in the past that don't appear to be what most of us consider the best decision. I think a lot of people remember 2008 when they put the Huskies and Rutgers, who were in the same conference at the time, together as number one and number two seeds, and not many people like that.
Well, one of the things that I think you make a very good case, if people are going to get on a plane to go to either Louisville or Lincoln, nobody's going to really, I don't think, drive to Louisville, Kentucky, although I'm sure that there are some diehard fans. This is one of the places, Charlie, where women's basketball is just a little bit different than the men's game. Men's brackets are set up so as to get the best possible matchups and, of course, put people in geographically proximate regions if possible. But the women's game really counts on the fact that you got to get fans there. It's the reason why UConn will play the first couple games at stores, right?
It is. That's typically been it's a shift the committee made about 10 years ago to go to predetermined sites so each of these cities or campuses could promote the fact that they were having tournament games in their arenas all season long. Well, actually, that part of it's coming to an end this year. Next year, they're going to go back to something they used to do where the top four seeds in each region will be the hosts. It provides a little, what most people think of as a little more fairness in the bracket. If you've earned a higher seed, you've earned the right to have a couple of home games, but it also allows for essentially 3 or 4 days of promotion to let people know that there are actually women's basketball games in your town. So that's the dilemma that the women's basketball committee and the NCAA in general has dealt with over the last, it's because there's such an economic component to this, balanced with the idea of how do we make the tournament as fair to the most people as possible. So this is actually the last year they're going to go to sub-regional predetermined sites. We can expect, I think, given the recent dominance of UConn's program, that the Huskies will continue to be hosting these first games for a long time. The other component to this year that's unique, that won't be in existence next year and wasn't in existence in the last decade or so, is that these in the regionals, the team who is serving as host is allowed to play in the regionals in their own arena. And that's where the Louisville component and the controversy, if you want to call it that, has come into play. That will change next year, too, where they'll go back to not allowing teams to host the regionals in their home floors. And that will alleviate a lot of this as well.
I got a tweet here from Patrick. He was jabbing at me about my joke about how it's, ho-hum, another UConn march to a title here. He says, there's nothing ho-hum about UConn Husky women's basketball. But, Paul Doyle, I just want to get to you before we run out of time here. You know, it's become such a tradition that I think many people in our state maybe take it for granted. Certainly we've seen less attendance in the last couple of years than at the start of the Gino Auriemma era here. What do you say to this, Paul? Do you think that people are starting to get a little ho-hum, or do you think that it's still going strong, this love for Lady Husky basketball?
Well, I think there is, there's a strong core of fans, and that hasn't eroded. I do think, they win so much that maybe people do take them for granted a little bit. Maybe shame on us, because it really, when you step away from it and you think about just how good this program is, it's amazing. And, here we've been living through conference realignment the last few years, and we see the men's pairings came out yesterday, and UConn's new conference, they were sort of hit hard. They didn't, Louisville didn't get a great seed. SMU wasn't even selected. So it's sort of an indictment on this new conference. Well, the UConn women, they haven't been affected by conference realignment at all. They're sort of on their own level. There's a national program, and, Gino Auriemma built that himself. So it really is amazing. Sometimes I think it's worth stepping back and just, sort of appreciating what a phenomenon it is and how unique it is.
I'm wondering, Charlie, if you think that the dominance of a few programs, including UConn, has been overall a good thing or a bad thing for women's college basketball. I mean, it seems as though, as Paul puts it, the UConn Lady Huskies could exist almost as Notre Dame does in men's football, not even without a conference, just on their own because they're just so very good and they've been so good for so long. A good thing or a bad thing for the sport, do you think?
It's a difficult question and sort of a mixed bag. I think the sport in general has gotten better, so the teams sort of right behind UConn are better. I think in this particular instance, this year, it's a good thing. The idea that UConn and Notre Dame, both undefeated, that's never happened before. The collision course that they seem to be on to play each other in the championship game, I think that game, if it does come to fruition, would be the biggest moment women's college basketball has ever seen. However, there is, in my travels, I talk to a lot of friends and family who aren't as tied into the women's game but love the men's game, and their reference point to the women's is, well, it's the same teams every year, and UConn would certainly be at the top of that list. So I think sort of under the radar, the game is getting better and deeper, but ultimately it is the same teams. But I think in the big picture, it's probably good, because as you're building a sport, as you're building anything, you need something recognizable about it. And UConn is the most recognizable part of women's basketball these days. And Gino is a face of not only UConn basketball, but women's basketball. And you need that if the sport is going to grow. You need someone to shoot for the rest of the teams. You need someone that general fans can point to and say, hey, I know who that is.
Charlie Cream is the basketball bracketologist for ESPNW Women's College Basketball. Charlie, thanks so much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Oh, sure.
I also want to thank Paul Doyle, who's a sports reporter for the Hartford Courant. If you want to read a really nice history of Connecticut sports, you can take a look at the Hartford Courant. You can also go to our website, WNPR.org, for links as well. Paul, thanks so much for sharing a little bit of history. Talk to you again soon.
Thank you, John.
Our program is produced by Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky, and this is Where We Live.